At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. And by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Which one do you want? The sexy big money glory of the dot-com story, or the grinded out nuts and bolts of what's actually happening to the economy? You'll get them both in due time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at shrinersforkids.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, February 1st. Great to have you with us. We begin today with the nuts and bolts. A, because it's more important. And B, because it's more important. For the first time in more than 4 years, the economy ended a month with fewer jobs than it started. It's not a big tilt to the negative. 17,000 fewer jobs in January, if you want the specific number. Many analysts are calling it the surest sign yet we're in a recession. But if you want some clarity out of today's report, well, it's just not there. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Focus on a few specific areas, and the numbers are stunning. More than 28,000 manufacturing jobs were lost in the past month. 27,000 construction workers were cut. But job placement expert John Challenger says this is hitting much like a tornado that leaves the neighbor right next door untouched.
We know financial services, housing market, automotive, those sectors in the economy are in recession. But at the same time, you look at healthcare and energy and global business. It suggests the economy is still really ticking strongly in areas outside of where the real problems lie.
Only adding to the confusion, the unemployment rate actually dropped slightly because fewer people were looking for work. Wachovia senior economist Mark Vittner saw something else curious in the latest numbers.
The weakness that you expected in construction and manufacturing was there, but we also saw small declines in employment in business and professional services, which is a part of the economy that generally tends to continue to grow even throughout a recession.
Could the numbers be suspect? They're always subject to revision. Indeed, today, the government revised its number for December payrolls sharply higher. And Vittner says even some of today's payroll estimates don't seem to add up.
We also saw some job losses at online retailers, which is very odd. I mean, Amazon had come out and said that they had their best Christmas ever. So we wouldn't expect to see job losses in a part of the economy that saw 25% growth in retail sales.
The contrasting signals could mean the numbers need a further look, or they might just mean the economy is tanking faster than many experts thought. Either way, analysts say the Fed is likely to maintain its interest-cutting insurance policy. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The gang that works in the PR department at Microsoft got up way early this morning. They had a big press release to get out, as you might have heard. The software company wants to buy Yahoo for almost $45 billion. It's not the first time CEO Steve Ballmer has proposed a get-together of the two high-tech giants. They were in talks last year, but Yahoo said no thanks because it was in the middle of a turnaround plan. That, of course, didn't work out so well. Its stock has given up more than 40% since October. CEO Jerry Yang announced earlier this week he's laying off 1,000 people. Now he's got an offer he might not be able to refuse. They won't say it outright, but both Yahoo and Microsoft are scared to death of Google and what it's been able to do so far, which means today's hostile bid could be the final step in the transition of the Internet. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli begins our coverage.
The proposed deal would create a duopoly in Internet search and advertising. In one corner, Google, which has 56% of the market. In the other, Yahoo and Microsoft, with a combined 30%. Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy says this isn't how the Internet was supposed to be.
The Internet is supposed to have been a thriving marketplace of ideas, the most diverse and dynamic system of communications ever developed. But in a few short years, what we've seen is that the same old powerful business forces that shaped the fate of old media, newspapers and broadcasting, is at work with so-called new media.
Business forces, meaning money. Companies consolidating so they can grab a bigger chunk of an online advertising market that's multiplying faster than friend requests on Facebook, from $40 billion last year to an expected $80 billion by 2010. Stacey Kramer of Paid Content says when there's that much at stake, say goodbye to the quirky upstart the Internet used to be.
You can say that it's the mainstreaming of the Internet. What this does is it elevates it beyond nascent and into a major force.
And would make Google and Microsoft more powerful than ever. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. So, Microsoft wants to buy Yahoo so that it can get you to stop using Google. But Google owns almost 60% of the online search market. And with good reason, says Tara Kalashain, editor of Research Buzz. She says back in 1998, Google set the standard with a powerful engine and a sleek design.
They had a search box and a couple of buttons, and that was it.
Kalashain says people also love Google because it's creative and dynamic. She says if the Microsoft Yahoo duo really wants to unseat Google, it would need to get innovative. But she says profit-focused Microsoft may not be able to get out of Yahoo's way.
Yahoo is doing so many innovative things right now. And I'm afraid if there's a Microsoft-Yahoo combination, all that stuff's going to be put to the wayside, and they're just going to try to assimilate the biggest search engine index possible.
But in this case, bigger could be better, says Tim Beharin with Creative Strategies. He says Google's search engine is the best right now, but there's room for improvement as people search for more photos, sound, and videos. And he says Microsoft's money and Yahoo's experience would make it a fierce competitor.
Ultimately, what I think the consumer wants is more precision in the search. They could combine their research labs to try to advance search.
Beharin says ultra-accurate searches would also be advertising gold because ads could be better tailored to a searcher's needs. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If you go to, say, Google right now and type in antitrust, the very first item that comes up has to do with Microsoft. The entry says the federal government's going to be keeping an eye on how the company sticks by its big antitrust settlement of several years ago for another couple of years, till 2009. It didn't take long for the Justice Department to chime in on today's proposed deal. Regulators say they are interested in its competitive implications. We figure Microsoft has some pretty experienced antitrust lawyers on staff, so we got Berkeley Law Professor Eric Talley on the phone for his guess as to what they might be doing.
Usually it's the case in an acquisition like this. The acquirer likes to make the market look extremely large so that the acquisition looks relatively modest. But in this case, Microsoft may take the other strategy, trying to draw the definition of the market in a fairly narrow way.
And how?
Google turns out to really, really dominate the online search engine market. And because of that, Microsoft can actually make it look like a combination with Yahoo is going to be pro-competitive as opposed to anti-competitive.
As often happens when a deal like this is announced, stock in one company goes up, the other drops. Yahoo added almost 48% today. Microsoft tumbled about 6.5%. The elephant in the room, Google, stumbled more than 8%. There was lots of other activity in the markets today. The world's largest publicly traded oil company gave up about 0.5% after posting the largest ever profits. Exxon announced this morning it cleared $11.5 billion last quarter, more than $40 billion for all of last year. Probably don't need to tell you, it broke its own record. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. The National Football League ought to be busy getting ready for its close-up this weekend. The league says the potential worldwide television audience for the Super Bowl is somewhere near a billion people. But instead, the NFL is trying to put the fear of God into some of them. It's issued an ultimatum to some churches across the country, saying public big-screen Super Bowl parties infringe the NFL's copyright. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The brouhaha started last year. The Fall Creek Baptist Church in Indianapolis was planning its annual Super Bowl bash. Hundreds were always invited to watch the game on a big screen TV. It was designed as a pigskin prayer service to evangelize sports fans. At halftime, instead of a wardrobe malfunction, the audience would see Christian videos. Then the letter came.
We were all just kind of stunned.
Marlene Broom, a church spokeswoman, opened the letter. It was from the NFL, and it said the church was violating an NFL copyright that limits private showings on big screens. She says the pastor backed down. This year, church members across the country are hosting small parties in their houses. But some say the NFL is a party pooper, especially since sports bars can still throw big-screen Super Bowl bashes. Intellectual property attorney Sherry Flax says the bars appealed to a higher power.
Why bars and not churches? Because bars long ago lobbied to get an exemption from the rule so that they could continue to attract customers.
Paul Fisher shakes his head as he sips a beer in a downtown Washington sports bar and wonders why bars got the exemption.
It's not fair. It doesn't make any sense.
But it's the law. The NFL makes it perfectly clear with this message broadcast during the Super Bowl.
This telecast is copyrighted by the NFL for the private use of our audience. Any other use of
the church has already got the message. They're now lobbying for their own exemption. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Of those billion or so people that could tune into the game on Sunday, a couple of million of them easy are in Mexico. It's home to the biggest football audience outside the U.S. and Canada. But still, the NFL wants it to be bigger. From Mexico City, Claudine LaMonaco reports on the league's Latin game plan.
Monday nights at movie theaters throughout Mexico City have sounded a lot like this lately. The cheering is for Brandon Jones, wide receiver for the Tennessee Titans. The NFL has been showing Monday night games on the big screen here for months. It's trying to grab more foreign fans and their money. Last year, Mexicans spent $18 million on official NFL gear, like T-shirts and hats. When the NFL played a regular season game here in 2005, more than 100,000 people went to see it. Geraldina Gonzalez heads the NFL's office in Mexico. She says Mexicans are drawn to football in part because it represents American culture.
Someone strong that I can trust, that is reliable, someone that is always excelling and looking for the best.
To win more fans in this soccer-obsessed country, the NFL is getting into the game early. The league sponsors nearly 200 flag football teams in grammar schools, like this one on Mexico City's south side. Once the kids understand the game, the thinking goes, they'll watch it. Not everyone is so thrilled about football in Mexico. Cab driver Alfonso Alvarado thinks the NFL's push here is another form of cultural imperialism, like the Walmarts and 7-Elevens cropping up everywhere. The 2005 live game was played in Mexico City's Aztec Stadium. It's one of the most famous soccer stadiums in the world.
People didn't like that they used this cathedral of soccer to see American football. I didn't like it at all.
Other Mexicans see the NFL's attention as a reversal of sorts. With so many Mexicans traveling to the States to find work, it's nice to see American teams heading south. In Mexico City, I'm Claudine LaMonaco for Marketplace.
So, David Johnson, tell me something, would you?
Mm-hmm.
Get paid double for a week like this, do you, with a rate cut and a big deal announced?
No, my half-life goes down.
That's right.
You can feel your heart up around your throat periodically. This was just, and today was a microcosm of the whole darn week. It was a wild week. But, you know, by the end of the week, by the end of this day, Everything sort of turned out, and there's a quiet assurance that everything is going to be all right. And, in fact, I should have known
baloney.
This.
Oh, baloney. Come on.
No. I'm telling you. You know why?
No, because I said baloney.
Oh. You take Newsweek?
I see it on the newsstands, yes.
I love Newsweek. First of all, I love Newsweek. I get more good economic and stock ideas out of Newsweek probably than I do Business Week.
So the plug now being given, your point is?
On the front of it is the road to recession. And there's this sort of black and white picture, and it looks like it's shot in Marfa, Texas, out there where they did Giant. Uh-huh. And there's a road just sort of going on forever. And it is, you go in here and there are articles about, you know, how to survive a recession and stuff like that. And typically when this stuff gets on, and it's not a reflection on the magazine, it's just a reflection on becoming mainstream. When you see a bull on the front of Newsweek, you sell. You sell. Everybody who wants into the market has all of their money in the market. When you see a headline that says, this is a recession, this stock market's, you know, got to go tank and everything else and run for the hills, that's it. Everybody who's really going to get out is out. And there's nobody left to sell. And all of a sudden, the buyers came in. I started seeing buyers this week. In fact, did you notice Microsoft was a buyer this week?
Gosh, yes, I did. How funny you mentioned that.
Well, no, I'm serious. That's an example of it. And did you see the story out today that Carl Icahn has started, you know, chipping away? He's buying into JCPenney. And retailers, who's that guy? Breeden has been buying into Zale Corporation.
Uh-huh.
These guys are buying on the bottom.
Have you not heard, man, about something called the unemployment report?
I know. And that's a real enigma, too. I mean, that one just surprised the heck. Well, I mean, it was such a surprise, it almost makes me think it's wrong. The Labor Department tells us they only get about 60% of the data to put these things together. A lot of pretty bright people were calling for a lot more than that. Merrill Lynch was calling for 100,000 job gains. Deutsche Bank, 160,000. Royal Bank of Scotland was calling for 150,000.
But hold on. Think how wrong the Labor Department would have to be for that to be true, right?
Well, I understand. I understand. And maybe it's just it's the anecdotal evidence. I talked for a long time to Burlington Northern Santa Fe the other day, you know, the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about it. I mean, here, you know, diesel fuel's going right through the roof and costing them an arm and a leg. And then all those shipments of plywood and all that other stuff tied to the housing market, that's drying up. And I asked, so how are you doing? They said, mm-hmm. We're doing great. There are other shipments that are taking the place of that. We're being able to put on a surcharge when the fuel prices go up and people are paying it. I mean, you know, that doesn't sound like a recession.
All right. Well, we shall see what we shall see. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
Oh, and pull for the Giants.
Yeah, absolutely. You better believe it. Coming up, dressing to impress even while the bank account hits bottom.
We call that retail therapy. You know, when you're feeling down and out, you know, you're not going to stop shopping. And I don't see anybody walking around naked, so people are buying clothes.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks overcame that weak job report and some less-than-stellar construction numbers today. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.7%, 92 points to close at 12,743. The Nasdaq climbed just shy of 1%, works out to 23 points, closed at 2413. The S&P 500 rose 1.2%, 16 points, ended the day and the week at 1395. For the week that was, the Dow rocketed 4.4% higher. Sure didn't feel like that somehow. The Nasdaq surged 3.8%. The S&P 500 soared 4.9%. A report from Motorola that it might spin off its mobile phone unit helped the communications company dial up more than a 10% gain. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.59%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. Florida's Senate Banking and Finance Committee holds 2 days of hearings on home insurance rates. France's prime minister gets an initial assessment on the Société Générale banking scandal. And President George Bush releases the 2009 budget to Congress. You can pick up your four-volume copy for $213 or get it on a CD-ROM for less than $25. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 2008's not starting too much better than last year ended for the major car makers. January was a lousy month for Detroit and its Japanese competition. Only General Motors posted a bump in sales. Overall, analysts expect about 15.5 million cars and trucks will be sold in this country this year. But the roads and bridges they're going to be driving on might not be up to the task. A congressional commission released an infrastructure report this morning, and Jeremy Hobson tells us its conclusions are pretty blunt.
Jeff Urema, one of the authors of today's report, says the nation's transportation system is in crisis.
Whether we've just woken up to it or known about it for a while, we've let it ride. And we've let it ride to the point we're about to fall off a cliff.
One of the problems, he says, is that the 18.4 cent per gallon federal gas tax is no longer enough to maintain aging roads.
First of all, our system is no longer modern. It is antiquated. So we needed much more money than we've had. Secondly, the gas tax has not been indexed to inflation. So, in fact, it's going down about 3 to 5% every year.
And he says more fuel-efficient cars mean more wear and tear on the system, but less tax revenue. One solution going forward, according to the report, user fees, like tolls or an odometer tax. Those are ideas that make sense to Martin Wax of the RAND Corporation.
If we don't tax the user at the time and place of use, the alternative is to pay for it out of our income taxes or sales taxes, and I think that's less fair.
But the Heritage Foundation's Ronald Utt says if drivers are going to pick up the tab, they want to see real results and less traffic.
We've been providing the public sector with all this tax revenue and whatnot for roads, but we have not been getting new roads in return for it.
Utt says part of the long-term solution is to get a significant amount of commuters off the roads by allowing people to work from home or at least closer to home. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Crude oil lost almost $3 today to settle below $89 a barrel. I told you that so I could tell you this. The Pentagon announced a new military cooperation pact with Kazakhstan today. The U.S. will assist the Central Asian country as it tries to bring its military up to NATO standards. How come? Think back to those oil prices I mentioned. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Kazakhstan is strategically important to the U.S. A strengthened military relationship could help in the battle against terrorism in neighboring Afghanistan. But that may not be the only motive at play.
It's also, of course, about natural resources.
That's Sean Roberts, Senior Asian Affairs Fellow at Georgetown University. Kazakhstan is home to some of the world's largest oil reserves. One of the biggest is under the Caspian Sea, where the U.S. plans to help the Kazakhs build up its navy. Roberts says a closer military relationship with the West makes Kazakhstan less reliant on Russia and potentially opens the way for new business relationships in the oil industry.
While not wanting to deliberately snub the Russians, they have continually been looking for other avenues to get their oil to market.
But not everyone agrees that military cooperation greases the way for business.
I really don't think that there's an economic component of this military pact.
That's Martha Brill Olcott with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
The Kazakhs have been playing hardball in recent months, or the last year or so, with Western investors in Kazakhstan. And there's no evidence at all of linkage between this increased military cooperation and any economic benefit for U.S. investors in Kazakhstan.
In recent months, Kazakhstan has renegotiated more favorable terms with international petroleum companies. And earlier this week, the country's energy minister proposed a new export duty on oil. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Fashion Week kicks off today in New York City. Top designers from Ralph Lauren to Zac Posen will be sending their fall lines down the runways. In a way, it's kind of a futures market because the beleaguered retail industry is betting on what consumers will be buying 6 months from now. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports on what we might be wearing if a recession knocks on the door.
In one episode of Sex and the City, a barely clad Carrie Bradshaw attempts to strut her stuff down the catwalk. For a few steps at least, until the star trips and falls flat on her face.
Oh my God, she's fashion roadkill.
This fashion week, retailers are worried they'll end up just like this Sex and the City star. Not just as fashion roadkill, but as business casualties too. Mike Zack is the owner of Circa 2000 outside of Dallas. His menswear boutique caters to executives and entrepreneurs. He says he's already cut his orders back 15% this year. Right now, he's buying cheaper fabric blends, less pure silk, and less cashmere. Unlike last year, he's also buying shirts that will retail for less than $100.
If things get tough, invariably people will lose their jobs and they're going to need interview clothes. So we get a little more conservative.
Zack says many designers haven't caught up with economic reality. The collections Tommy Hilfiger, Donna Karan, and other designers are showing this week were created months ago, before the economic doom was clear.
In Italy, a couple weeks ago, they were showing a lot of vested suits. Well, a vest in a suit today adds $250 to $300 to a suit. Well, I don't think that anybody that's going through a tough time wants to spend an extra $300.
Like many store owners, Zack plans to order less from Italy. He says the soaring euro makes too many of their designs too expensive. Buyers for boutiques and big department stores are faced not just with what to buy for a recession, but how much. If they order too much, they'll get stuck with inventory and take losses. But if they order too little, they lose profits and customers. Stacy Picor is the owner of Olive & Betty's, a 15-year-old chain of four boutiques in Manhattan. Picor caters to what she calls Upper West Side stroller moms and Upper East Side private school girls.
That'd be great for her over a dress, over something.
Picor's business was growing 20% a year. Last year, it grew just 3%. Impulse shoppers have closed their purses faster than Wall Street's private equity investors.
Now, all of a sudden, these women who have a closet full of clothes need something that really hits them emotionally that they want to buy.
So she's writing smaller orders from a larger group of designers to see what sells. She's trying bright colors, unusual weaves, and new shapes.
Is instead of going to the vendors that we've gone to consistently, is we're going out there and saying, we need, because our customer's demanding it, newness and freshness and innovation.
Even though the economy is gloomy, that doesn't mean fashion has to be. Arthur Zaskowitz is the senior financial editor at Women's Wear Daily. He says buyers bought bright colors and bold prints for spring, even after the market started tumbling. And for fall, more than black will be back.
There's a lot of color, and it's kind of a mood lifter, which I think everybody needs. We call that retail therapy. You know, when you're feeling down and out, you know, you're not going to stop shopping.
And this week, we'll find out how the designers think we should make a fashion statement during a recession. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, and the reason you heard Johnson rooting for the Giants back there, as you're watching the big game this weekend, keep this phrase in mind, Super Bowl indicator. It says that if a team from the old American Football League wins the Super Bowl, the market's going to drop. If the winner comes from the original National Football League, like my New York Giants, the market's in for a rally. It's actually been right about 85% of the time, so the Pats are favored, but they're from the AFL. They might be 18-0, but I don't know. I'm just saying. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow packed on 92.7%. The NASDAQ rose 23 points, less than 1%. The S&P 500 climbed 16 points. That is 1.2%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, controversy over the recipe of a special Berlin sausage.
You see, you can take this ground sausage for the currywurst, you can take it and eat it with mustard, and then it's certainly not a Berliner currywurst.
Certainly. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.